to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines, hopefully provide some insight and analysis, a practical application that you can take back to the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And if you go to a meeting with HR and there's plastic on the floor, you may be working for a ransomware gang or the mafia, and they're probably there to talk to you about retirement.
You know, there's days where I almost wish. Anyways.
All right. So what we're talking about today is a write-up from Krebs, which is a four-part series on the Conti ransomware group diaries, which is, of course, comes to us from Krebs on security. And this is a overview of the group as it's seen by a review of some Jabber logs, which were released on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. And a little background. So Conti is a Russian cybercrime group with over 100 salaried employees that focuses on ransomware companies that are worth more than $100 million in annual revenue. And these chats are from January 29th of 2021 to the 3rd of March this year, and from June 22nd of 2020 to November 16th of 2020. And they were released from a Twitter account called TrickBot Leaks.
You know, I applied there. I didn't get a call back.
Maybe that's for the best.
Yeah. Yeah. In retrospect.
My problem is when I interviewed with them, I didn't understand what the hell they were asking me. My Russian's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But this TrickBot Leaks is supposedly a Ukrainian patriot who is staying in his country to fight Russia.
I find that concept of like online partisans super interesting because, you know, in history and wars in the past, you know, Vietnam, World War II, like civilians picking up weapons and fighting off the invaders has happened throughout history. But cyber warfare is new. So I kind of assume there's going to be an online equivalent going forward of like online partisans, right? And what would the government do? Would the government just ignore them? Would the government try and coordinate and tell them who to attack? How does that work?
Well, I think it would work the same way that partisans had worked in the past. They do what they can on their own and hope for support from agencies or organizations larger than from themselves. You know, either their own government or, you know, other governments like the U.S. is pouring funding into Ukraine now, or other NATO countries are pouring funding into Ukraine now. Probably the same kind of thing, whereas, you know, in the back in the like World War II times, they would drop weapons and some trainers on occasion behind lines to teach partisans how to do attacks and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was Green Berets. That was their job, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for the most part, Green Berets are trainers.
So,
but I was going to say, in this case, the Ukrainian Minister of Digital Transformation, Fedoros, has announced the creation of an army of IT specialists to fight for Ukraine in cyberspace. And this is apparently being organized over Twitter.
And Telegram.
Telegram. That's right. I knew I was going to get that wrong too. Because I kept saying in my head, Twitter, even though it was Telegram, and I wrote Telegram, but let's see, here or there.
We got to get that important in case anybody listening decides to go fight for them.
Right. So
actually, now I'm curious. I'm going to go see on Telegram. Like,
well, I don't have an account. So when I went there, I didn't really see anything.
But I have an account I don't use.
In Steve Gibson's podcast earlier this week, he said there were over 200,000 people that signed up via this Telegram thing to be in this IT army or whatever for Ukraine.
Jesus. I see three channels for Ukraine, and one of them is filled with horrible pictures of what's going on there. And I can't read any of them. They're all in Ukrainian or Russian.
I should have put the link in here in the show notes, but I can get the link later and send it to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause part of this, what I was thinking about was we've talked in the past, right? About how generally speaking, most countries don't care what you do online as long as you're doing it outside of the country, you know, where right. State-sponsored actors in Russia and China are hitting on the US and the government doesn't care as long as they're hitting on the US. And we hypothesize that the same thing was happening in the US, where as long as you're hitting on, you know, Russian or Chinese websites, you're totally fine. I'm curious if there's like, I know like Anonymous is supposedly fighting on behalf of Ukraine, and other accounts and other places are supposedly fighting on behalf of, I don't know, this whole thing. This just seems like a brand new thing to me. I mean, we had a little bit of it back in Crimea in 2014. We've had a little bit of this in the past, but this seems like the first modern war where cyber could be, you know, on the similar footing as the kinetic part.
I don't know. I kind of think it's overblown personally, at least based on what I'm reading about what these guys are doing. I feel like DDoS websites and stuff. I was like, you know, you're really not probably impacting the actual war effort through these kinds of, I don't know if they call them childish, but these low-level attacks. Mm-hmm. Versus actually going in and being able to disrupt their logistics or something through a cyber attack. So I think this is really, it's kind of on the surface. It's not really digging in and actually impacting the war effort, I don't think.
But that's kind of like partisans in a regular war effort too. Like they're going around just shooting Nazis or whatever. Like they're not necessarily, you still need somebody to kind of direct and be like, here's the important target, you know, launch your attacks, you know, behind the lines the night before the real attack starts.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, partisans typically have more of a larger impact in smaller areas, you know, because mm-hmm. that's where they'll operate in. And this is one of the things about the cyberspace is because cyberspace is so huge, there's no real operational area for somebody unless you want to say, well, these guys are focused on a particular type of attack. You know, these guys are focused on doing DDoS and these guys are focused on website defacement or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I could say, you know, it's those, they're regionalized attacks as far as that kind of thing goes, based on the skill set of those people who are conducting the attacks.
Yeah. Anyways, I don't want to take us too far offline. I just think that we're going to point back to this as being kind of the first time where this has been like a real big, real interesting part of the fight.
Yeah, even though I don't think it's going to be very effective. I think
it never is at first, right?
Right. Well, as you know, Wushneyer says, attacks only get better. So I imagine that this kind of cyber partisans will only get better as well.
They just need to know where to go. They just need to know what to hit. So they're not just hitting, you know, Russia Today's website or whatever.
Right. Exactly. And actually, they at the Telegraph space for this digital transformation, they do have a list of URLs that they're interested in being attacked. And just based on that, it kind of makes me think also that, you know, do these guys even know what they're doing as far as cyber attacks go?
I mean, they might not. I don't know.
Because I didn't think that was a very, you know, my impression anyway was that that was not a good target list. But of course, I'm not in their boots. So I can't really speak to what they're thinking.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of, what are they trying to combat? Are they trying to combat propaganda? Are they trying to, you know, dig in and release embarrassing files that maybe show, like if I were them, I'd probably be having the hackers looking for evidence of false flag operations. Cause there's been a ton of that back and forth. Like recently there was the Russians said that the US was helping Ukraine with bioweapons, and then Pentagon said there's no bioweapons. And then I saw that Tucker Carlson said that the Pentagon confirmed there is bioweapons. Although nobody's going to believe that anyways. So
you know, they could do. Maybe it would make more sense for them to put out a target list and then have a separate bounty list. Say, hey, here are your potential targets, which is a series of URLs or maybe a bunch of IT blocks, or IP blocks would probably be better. Mm-hmm. But say, all right, here's where you're targeting. This is what we're looking for. And for whatever you bring back, there'll be a bounty for it. So if you bring back definitive evidence of a false flag attack being planned for by Russia or executed by Russia, you'll get a bounty on it. Kind of like letters of mark and reprisal, kind of.
Ooh, which we talked about. That'd be awesome. See, that's, you know what? That would actually be awesome. If the US, rather than getting involved in the war itself, started issuing letters of mark and reprisal, that would be super interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be better overall if we did that both in the physical and the cyberspace instead of a lot of the crap that we do now.
Well, there's people that are talking about, and I'm sure most of them are just talk online to, you know, look badass about how I'm going to go and, you know, go help Ukraine. I would help Ukraine by absorbing one, you know, 50-cent bullet. Wait, hold on. Ammo's expensive these days. I would go and help by absorbing one, like, $3 bullet. And then I would be super not useful at all.
Yeah.
Battlefield.
Actually, you know, one round of 5.56 is actually like 60 cents now.
Oh, okay. See, I wouldn't even have as much of an impact as I thought I would.
But they do 7.62, so it's probably a little bit more expensive.
Fair enough.
AK-47s.
Fair.
But yeah, like I said before, you know, if they'd put like sent out a letter of marque de reprisal on Osama bin Laden, said $2 billion,
mm-hmm.
you know,
would have been cheaper than the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah. I mean, we spent what, $3 trillion or $6 trillion? Something like that.
It was all made up money that they printed anyways.
Yeah. But I'm pretty sure one of his bodyguards would have been like, so I cap this dude in the head. I throw him over the back of my motorcycle and I drive across the border. You know, I collect my $2 billion.
Yeah. Yep. That makes sense.
But of course, it also has to be believable that we would pay instead of doing the lawyer thing and say, well, actually.
you didn't bring him back in a live condition or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we asked for his scalp, and he's obviously not scalped, so you're not getting your $2 billion. All right. Well, so we're way off track here. But so this stuff was leaked through Twitter, and there's some things here that Krebs had mentioned about, you know, this could be a huge reputational problem for the Conti group now, because their comms have been infiltrated, and it may be difficult for them to recruit and actually conduct operations now because people won't trust that their comms are secure.
And especially with as little as they're paying, but we'll get into that.
Yeah. Well, probably they knew that before because of the job postings. But anyway.
They're posting their jobs.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Before we get there, so there are gaps in the chat logs. And these seem to correspond to a couple of different instances in the Conti gang's life cycle where they were either infiltrated by security researchers or private law enforcement had taken them down or whatever, as well as different periods where they had just gone quiet because they were dealing with their own internal problems and potentially dismissing staff as a security precaution. For instance, on September 22nd of 2020, the NSA began was described as a weeks-long operation in which it seized control over the TRIC botnet. TrickBot botnet. And what was interesting about this instance is within hours of NSA initiating this operation, the core group's leadership knew something had gone wrong and that their infrastructure had been compromised, which means they were at least, I'm not sure, just because maybe they lost control of a certain number of bots, they're like, okay, you've been hosed, or if they actually have some kind of monitoring in place from like an intrusion detection, you know, incident response perspective or not.
Yeah, there were some chats that Krebs picked up on where they were talking about things like, these guys are good. You know, they shut down our backup channel because they had a backup channel, which I thought I mentioned somewhere in here. Was that somewhere else? But they had a backup. Yeah. They had a backup method of regaining control if they lost control of their bots that involved using a distributed DNS server service. It wasn't the .eth one. It was a different cryptocurrency or a different blockchain, but I found that really interesting.
Yeah. The Ember DNS, which is a decentralized DNS service.
Yeah. That makes me wonder how to detect that, because that would be something that those types of distributed DNS things, which are cool, but they're not being used by most legitimate people right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like that might be a really interesting indicator.
Yeah, that would be something you could use with your risk-based learning to bump up a score.
Yeah.
But I mean, catching this within a few hours is much better than most organizations do trying to find these guys.
Yeah. That's
so, yeah. So after this event, you know, it took the gang several weeks to rebuild their malware infrastructure. And another instance was where in January 26th of 2021, international law enforcement seized control of Emotet, which actually involved the Russian government as well. And when that happened, the Conti group reorganized and forced everyone to pick new nicknames and passwords. So basically entirely new usernames and passwords, not just new passwords. So everybody's accounts got nuked and they created new accounts.
That's interesting. Do they have a mapping? Does Krebs have a mapping of old account to new account at all? I mean, I'm sure it's not as easy as just picking it out, but they might be able to pick out by their roles and the way they chat.
Well, a couple of times in here, one of the characters is named Stern, and apparently he's also referred to as Van, VAN. So that's one of the few instances, at least within the Krebs article, that indicates that he knew that the guy was going by a couple of different handles.
Interesting.
And maybe that was a before and after the 2021 thing. I'm not sure. But the U.S. government had given the Russian government information about the people behind TrickBot in October of 2021. And when this happened, the Contiware Group's top folks were tipped off by some people they had on the payroll in Russian law enforcement, indicating that they and indicating that their that an investigation into them had been rekindled. So apparently Russia, that's not the first time Russia had looked into this, but their investigation had been stopped in the past for some other reason, which is not noted here. But apparently Russia was less interested in TrickBot and more interested in Arevil, or Arevil, however you want to pronounce that. And on January 14th of 2022, so about 3 months later, the Russian government arrested 14 people relating to the Arevil gang. But apparently, even with them dodging that bullet, messages within the Jabber log seem to indicate that TrickBot was shut down this month anyway. But getting into some of the operational aspects of how this gang operated. So within the transcripts, there was a lot of information in here about the ransomware negotiations. And apparently there were several conversations in there where victims had paid Conti just to ensure their silence. So not having seen the logs myself, I'm not sure if we know exactly which companies these are that were breached and ransomware, but no one seems to know that this actually took place because they kept it all hush hush.
Someone will eventually translate and release those. So I thought what was most interesting about the negotiations was there were several comments in there about the Conti gang knowing and working with the negotiators. Where
we'll get to that in a little bit later.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No, that's fine. This part should have been moved in the notes down to that part anyway.
Well,
don't you know how to organize show notes, Matt?
Apparently not.
Terrible. Terrible. But the Conti Group operates really like a small business, with the exception of they have virtually no back-end staff, no administrative staff other than human resources, which actually in the chat log seemed to really overlap with folks within there. So I wouldn't say they necessarily had an HR department so much as they had managers that were doing HR functions. But the group was organized into, in addition to HR, five under other groups: coders that write malicious code, testers that test the malicious code, administrators that stand up the servers and the other attack infrastructure, reverse engineers who reverse engineer looking for vulnerabilities and weaknesses in code, and then the penetration tests / hackers. We're actually on the front lines actually doing the data theft and the data encryption.
So something stands out to me here. The fact that they have their own reverse engineers indicates to me that, number one, they didn't buy exploits from other people. They generated their own exploits. And they may or may not have had 0 days.
Oh, right, because they may have been producing their own 0 days.
It seems like that would have been a role that would be pretty easy. I mean, you're next. I'm gonna steal some of your thunder, but your next bullet here says that it appears they contracted out their spamming operations because there's no mention of spammers as a direct employee. But it seems like the reverse engineers, like purchasing exploits, was another place that it seems like it would have been awful easy to outsource.
Right, and you and I have talked about this in the past where, you know, these cyber gangs, it makes more sense for them to focus on one particular area and then outsource the other parts of it.
Administrating? Maybe
what's that?
Like administrating their infrastructure? Because apparently they're pretty bad at that.
Yeah. So maybe they don't have spammers or anything, and they just go through access brokers to get access, maybe. And that would be the one section which you would expect to see on this list that isn't present. But they actually post ads for looking for folks on cybercrime forums, offering salaries of $2,000 a month. And apparently there were folks on these cybercrime forums who are like, well, that's just pennies on the dollar. You're not paying for what people are worth for that. And Conti, of course, disputes this, saying, well, we pay you what you're worth. You know, the base is $2,000.
Ooh.
And if you actually are somebody that's worth it, you can make $5,000 to $10,000.
Yeah, I saw later they mentioned that the majority of people made 1 to 2K. So we do some estimation later, but they didn't provide really numbers on how what you had to do or who was making the 10K a month salary. 10K a month salary is $120,000 a year. That's a pretty decent salary, especially given that most of these coders are probably what, Eastern European? Did it mention where they were? Or are they global?
Well, somewhere in here, they mentioned that they go on vacation to Crimea. So I assume they're actually in Russia or Ukraine, probably. And I don't know what the cost of living over there is, but I bet it's less than, you know, Vienna. But what I also found interesting is, you know, they have these employees that they're paid 2K a month or whatever, but these people are running literally a 24/7 shop, testing, maintaining, and expanding the infrastructure every day of the year. There are no weekends with the Conti ransomware group.
That's funny.
And as of July 18th of 2021, they were employing 62 people, but their roster, you know, fluctuates because, you know, working a 24/7 shop, they get burnt out and they have to toss people every so often because of potential security risks.
That's, you see, this is where some of the things that I don't understand. The salary is so low, but this is a dangerous job to take. Like, especially the low-level coders, they're the ones that are going to get thrown under the bus. What is it? Hold on. I'm going to look up what the average salary is.
Oh, you mean for someone in Russia, just the average person, average salary in Russia?
Yeah, because I want it, like, it's $2,000 a month. Like, we've talked about this before. Like, in order to risk breaking the law and getting arrested and going to jail, you need to make enough money to make it worth it. So the nominal salary is 56,000 Russian rubles. That is actually not very helpful because the Russian ruble is not worth very much right now, is it?
Oh, you can't do a really good translation right now as far as what that looks like. Well, you can probably look back in time to see what the ruble was worth in January.
So after looking it up and doing the conversion, the standard, the average Russian salary for a month is approximately $840 US after conversion.
So their base is not quite triple what the average salary is. That's not bad.
No, but again, in US dollars, what's the average salary in the US? The median's like what, 50,000? So that'd be about making $150,000 in the US.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you ask, you go to somebody who's making $50,000 and say, I'm going to triple your salary.
Yeah. But, and you may be arrested.
Well, I don't know. I think part of this also goes to the overall trust of the Conti organization. Because if you're, let's say that Conti approaches you and say, hey, we want to hire you to come and be one of our pen testers or whatever, our penetration people, and performing this job, you're going to operate from our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Now, if you trust that Conti has a well-designed infrastructure that's going to present or prevent them from being able to trace it back to you, then maybe your risk really is not that high. Or, you know, if you trust that they have good infrastructure.
I mean, you're right. Like, if somebody approached me and said they would triple my salary to hack exclusively sites in Russia, that would probably be pretty safe. Or China.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, and if they have a really good, well-designed infrastructure that potentially obfuscates it being tied back to you at all, because they mentioned maintaining VPNs.
Okay, they did. Because that's going to be my next question, is did they leave it kind of on you to use your own VPN and do your own OPSEC, or?
No, because they have these people that they call the administrators that set up, tear down the servers and other attack infrastructure. And they mentioned that the gang pays for VPNs as well. So I think this might not be as dangerous as you think it is, or as people may assume it is, if this is, you know, if they have a well-designed infrastructure. And even with this leak, I have not heard about any of these gang members being arrested yet.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, we were just talking about, what was it the Revol gang had 14 people arrested, and they probably had a similar base of employees.
Right. Yeah, they're probably competing for employees there. But anyway, so yeah, in July of 2021, they had 62 people, mostly low-level coders and software folks. And in May of that year, they said they were looking to hire 100 more encoders. I'm not sure exactly what that term means in this context, to join the penetration testing / hacking team. And by the end of July, they had increased the amount of folks working for them to 87 with more hires on the way, supposedly.
Well, they're busy. They're making money.
But Conti may not be, you know, may not have emerged in fully in armor like Athena from Zeus's forehead, but came out of the Ryuk ransomware group, which was first spotted by the FBI in 2018 and had been earning more than $61 million a year in ransom payouts. But what's interesting is even though this may have come from Ryuk, or this company may have, or this organization may have been built off of Ryuk, a lot of the folks within the organization didn't realize that that was the case. And there are some chat logs where people are kind of confused about some of the stuff that cross over from Ryuk to Conti. And one of the hackers is indicates that he's kind of miffed that something he wrote was also used by Ryuk.
Yeah. And we had some discussions about that before we started the podcast, but the standout thing to me there is if that guy wrote it, then Ryuk can't have been the original. Ryuk, like if the original for that file had to be Conti. And you suggested that maybe the managers were passing information back and forth.
Right. Like maybe the leaders of the Conti group were actually the leaders of Ryuk also. And they were just stealing parts from the different teams and cross-pollinating across the two different ransomware groups, operating them both at the same time. Like they are both the executives for two different companies at the same time. So they're kind of like moonlighting. And we were also theorizing that maybe this is like a Dread Pirate Roberts kind of scenario where, you know, the core folks, they just purge them and then they start up a new ransomware group with new folks and just say, well, it's now Conti, but the core group is still the Ryuk team.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't really talk about the coders, but generally speaking, in most companies, you've got like a couple guys that are the main coders that know everything and know like all the details. And then you've got a bunch of supporting coders that are working on like add-ons or new features or stuff like that. So like, I can see where if you keep a couple of guys centrally and then, you know, build out the supporting team around them, like the, that maybe is, you know, building the stagers and stuff like that, but maybe they're not involved in the malware itself.
Yeah. I'm imagining that the core group of, you know, however large the core group is, I'm guessing, you know, five guys or less probably actually built the original malware. And then these other folks just help them deploy and maintain it.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
But Conti tends to focus heavily on the hospital system. And on October 26, one of the managers within the Conti group says that they're going to start attacking clinics in the United States. And there will be a panic, 428 hospitals. And this was on October 26th, that they said this of 2020. And on the 28th of October, the FBI and the DHS assembled a conference call with the healthcare industry warning about an imminent cybercrime threat to U.S. hospitals and healthcare providers, which seems to indicate to me anyway that the FBI and DHS are in these guys' comm channels already in October of 2020. So 2 years ago, or actually a year and a half ago, the FBI and the DHS were already reading these guys' comms, which kind of makes you wonder, you know, if they were reading their comms a year and a half ago, why didn't they, haven't they done anything about them yet?
I don't know.
And apparently at this time, you know, in the fall of 2020, it was not uncommon for the healthcare industry to see at least one hospital or healthcare facility ransomware every day, which is crazy if you think about it. But that also kind of goes to the amount of profits these guys were seeing.
Well, and we'll look at it later too, and especially how mediocre these guys seem to be.
Well, operationally, their software seems to be pretty good.
That's fair.
So it's good programmers that are not really good at operationalizing things. But in May of 2021, I'm sure most of you remember this, where Ireland's healthcare service was hit with ransomware. And it took them from May until September to fully restore their systems. And the estimated cost of that was $600 million. And you can kind of see why people would lean towards wanting to pay these folks. Because if it's going to cost you $600 million in 6 months, where you could pay them $5 to $10 million and restore service within a couple of weeks. That's a very enticing prospect. But of course, in this instance, you're talking about government who, you know, none of these things matter, time nor money. But the county, each employee is assigned a specific 5-day work week. So even though they're a 24/7 shop, you generally are only working 5 days a week. Although they mentioned that someone was working really long hours, even though they're only supposed to be working a 5-day work week.
Yeah. So what's interesting to me here is that they maintain better coverage than most SOCs and most security teams.
Yeah. Well, what I'm wondering is, you know, you get these five different teams. You don't need 24/7 for most of these folks.
Yeah. You don't need reverse engineers 24/7. You don't need testers. So you do need testers. You do need testers 24/7 because they talk later about how they have to test it every time new Microsoft Defender stuff comes out.
Right. So I think the testers and the administration folks are probably 24/7.
Yeah. I imagine the pen testers. No, just due to the time changes, the pen testers are probably already working kind of in the ideal slot for them, you know, after hours and in the US.
After hours in the US is probably prime time in Russia. I haven't looked at the time zones for that though.
That makes sense to me.
But they actually have a payroll where they pay out on the 1st and the 15th of every month in Bitcoins to the employees.
Which seems really interesting to me because it feels like if they ever figure out what the main group's wallet is, it'd be super easy to find the people that work for them because of the ledger. I mean, I guess they're smart enough to use a mixer, no doubt, to anonymize the currency before depositing. But are they anonymizing each and every deposit, or are they anonymizing, you know, the ransom related Bitcoins one time through the mixer and then putting it into their own wallet and distributing their, you know, payroll through there? I feel like that could be a potential weakness.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that they were using Bitcoin instead of
Monero or something.
Monero or a different crypto that's supposedly harder to track. But it could be that their payroll wallet and their ransomware wallets are, you know, on the other side of that mixer. And of course, because this is chat, and I mean, everybody working from home, I'm sure there's a lot of folks have a chat channel set up for their different teams that they're working on. So they're within the Conti chat. There's a lot of the same kind of complaints and stuff that you'll see in regular corporate chats about the amount of work days that they have to go without sleep or breaks while managers hassle them about getting their stuff done.
This is like any other toxic workplace.
Yeah, it's just like any other small business. I mean, they got timelines and bottom lines they have to meet. So even with all these employees, and what Matt and I are talking about, they might be good programmers, but they're poor with the operational side of it, is they've lost control of thousands or actually countless numbers of bots. And each one of those bots equates to some level of payday for these guys. And they seem to kind of take it in stride based on the chat logs. But on top of losing track of their bots, they lose track of their infrastructure. So there's a bunch of different chats in here about past due invoices for virtual servers and domain registrations, cloud resources, VPNs. Let's see, they failed to pay the anchor domain as a result of that. They lost a whole bunch of bots in 2020.
So this makes me wonder, we talked a little bit before about how they had a backup protocol to maintain control of their bots. And my first thought was that was to prevent, you know, from other people seizing it or from the government seizing it. But maybe that was just to prevent them from losing them.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, all right, so we've screwed this up a couple times. Somebody put a backup channel in there so we can get them back.
Yeah, that way, you know, if we fail to pay one domain registration, the backup one will still be available, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's amazing with, you know, their even with this poor operational stuff, they were still making a ton of money. It's estimated by Chain Analysis that the Conti Group generated $180 million in revenue last year, which is ridiculous.
Is unreal. And I went ahead and did just some quick math because they said that most people made $1,000 to $2,000 per month. So I estimated 60%. Then I estimated, you know, 30% were making between $5,000 and $10,000 per month, since they mentioned that. And then maybe 10% the managers were making 12K per month. And all this added up to about $4.5 million per year for their staff. They made $180 million per year. So their personnel costs were like under 5%. It was like 3%, 2.5%.
Yeah. And if you guess that, you know, they spent a similar percentage on their infrastructure and, you know, these VPNs and all these other stuff that they're maintaining. So that still only takes it to about $170 million
left.
That's going to the overall leadership of the Conti group.
Yep.
And when you're talking about the average person makes $800 a month, and these guys are pulling in 170 split across, you know, like I said, maybe half a dozen guys. That is crazy money.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, and this must be some kind of addiction for these guys too. Because I tell you what, you know, if I made $5 million in 1 year, I might just retire and not.
Then you can't afford a mega yacht.
But if I have a mega yacht, then the U.S. government's just going to steal it when I have it parked in an Italian dock. So it makes more sense not to do that. So, you know, this must be some kind of addiction where these guys have to, or, you know, they just want more versus, you know, doing this for 1 year and then retiring on that.
You know, if they get oligarch status, then they can help rule their country.
Supposedly.
I mean, that works any country you're in. Once you got a couple $100 million, they start listening to you.
Oh, that's for just that. That's Bill Gates or Zuckerberg.
Yeah. Yeah. They aren't asking me to go talk to the Senate.
That would be quite funny, though. I'd pay to see that. It's on tickets to that one.
Yeah. Just start cussing them out. See how long it takes before they drag me out.
Oh, I've yet to see that. That would probably go down in the Hall of Fame. You know, if you actually got drug out of there by the Capitol Hill police because you're going on some kind of tirade at the microphone, be kind of awesome.
You're right. But then it would be in the news forever, and good luck trying to find another job after that, right?
Right. Maybe you could live off your book deal. But, you know, with all this money that's coming in and everything, and the management, according to Krebs, constantly being on top of these folks to get their work done, he never really mentions any comments or any texts or anything in the chat where there's threats of violence or coercion, which I thought was interesting. You know, maybe that's something they only do in person or over the phone or something.
Maybe they don't have to. They're paying these people three times. Like, I know it's not necessarily a death sentence. Like, these guys are coders. They can go make a living somewhere else doing something else, but it's good money. Maybe that's enough of a carrot that they don't have to threaten them. Maybe they discovered if you pay people well, you don't have to threaten them.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I just thought it was interesting because when you think about criminal gang, you know, you think about what you've seen in the movies and everything where there is always an element of coercion or violence, either explicit or implicit in their conversations or in their dealings. Whereas that, at least according to what Krebs has relayed in these articles, is that's not present here. And they don't need to do that.
Well, I think there's a couple of things probably going on. They coerce us as human beings to do all kinds of stuff that's really bad for us all the time through money. You know, going down and being a coal miner, they just have to pay a little more than all the people around them in the crappy little town or whatever. And they'll go down and die early of lung disease. People working the night shift, an extra buck or two an hour, and that shortened your life by years. I think paying them two or three times the average salary, like paying them really well for at least comparatively, what is a very, very low chance of being arrested? Maybe enough. Like and it may depend also on what's considered morally wrong too. You're not asking these people to kill anybody. There's no violence that they're doing to people. It's all abstracted away through computer programs. And you're attacking the rich people over in the US. You know, all those, you know, clueless people that they've got so much money they don't know what to do with. Like, we're not hurting them. We're not hurting those capitalist companies. I just don't know that. Gaining,
They're also gaining skills on top of this. So this is still a job where they're actually learning things as well. So it's on the job training for this.
I mean, we get people to do that in the US through patriotism. You know, hey, join the army, kill some people for your country, and we'll pay you less. But they do it for, you know, patriotism and maybe the opportunity to shoot somebody.
For certain people, that's appealing.
Yeah. I don't know. I just don't think there needs to be violence in this case. I think it may be different if they were doing something, I don't know, maybe more like there's a higher chance of getting caught, or if they were doing something more dangerous, like if they were ransomwaring people by like locking up their heart monitor or something, or their pacemaker, that may be different.
Yeah, I just wanted to juxtapose that against what people think of when they think of criminal organizations.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you mostly think of what, like the Colombians down in South America, which are incredibly ultra-violent. Yeah. And
quite scary.
Yeah. Man, how would this be different if it was the Colombia gangs? They'd be like, we're ransomwaring this, and if you don't pay the ransom, we're going to go to your house and kill your family. It's like a combination crime.
Now, in addition to the blackmail.
Yeah. Yeah. Because these guys, if you don't pay the ransom, they're just like, all right, you don't get your data back. And they move on to the next one.
Right. It is not worth the effort.
Yeah. The Colombians throw like a bonus drive by in with it. All right. That wasn't as funny as I thought it'd be. We can move on.
Right. So on top of paying the employees and, you know, those VPNs and the other infrastructure stuff that they're paying for, they also pay for a whole bunch of security tools, which is, you know, interesting in a couple of aspects, because the security tools aren't always purchased simply for testing on how to get around them, but they're also purchased in order to monitor the other members of the group. And so in one text, they say, well, ensure that EDR is on every administrator's workstation, set up more complex storage system. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that. Protect LSAS dumps on all computers. Only have one active account, install the latest security updates, install software, install firewalls on all networks.
Because you hired a bunch of hackers. Like, I'm amused. Again, this is a place that has better security than most of the places they're hacking.
Yep. And when the management of the group was called out for this, and this is, you know, the rationality of this whole thing is that when, and this is a quote from one of the managers of the group, when that kind of money and people from the street come in who have never seen that kind of money, how can you trust them 1,000%? I've been working here for more than 15 years and haven't seen anything else.
So I know you're going to talk about the 15 years thing, but before that, they're right. Like, what if you got like a $10 million ransom in Bitcoin and the person who's, you know, waiting around for the, to do the negotiation, he just forwards the Bitcoin to his personal account and then walks out the door and disappears.
Yeah, this reminds me of the stories about the diamond mines, about watching the folks who are actually working on the diamond mines to ensure that they aren't stealing diamonds.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing. You know, because essentially what you're talking about is at any one moment, a member of this gang may be holding in their hand, you know, virtually more money than any of us will probably see in our life.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to, and this guy is saying, of course, we're not going to trust anybody in that case.
Mm. I don't know. I'd trust myself. If you wouldn't trust you. You're sitting there and the ability to just copy and paste your own wallet address in, or heck, you wouldn't even have to tell them. You could, when you're negotiating, you just send them your own personal wallet address instead of the ransomware gang's wallet address. And you're like, oh, they didn't pay. Like, yeah, I totally get why they don't trust them.
Yeah, but in that text, like Matt was saying, the 15 years part here. So 15 years ago was 07?
Yeah, there was no ransomware. What was the first year ransomware came out? Wasn't it like 2016?
Oh, no, it's way earlier than that.
Was it?
I want to say it was 2014, 2015, maybe.
Oh, well, the first known instance of a ransomware attack was 1989, but that's not exactly what I was looking for.
No. But anyway, 15 years.
Crypto Locker was 2013. Crypto Locker was 2013. So that was the first like big widespread one.
Yeah. So this guy was when he says, I've been working here more than 15 years. So when he says here, that seems to indicate that there's some kind of cohesion of his employment since 07.
Yeah.
Before they were even doing ransomware.
Yep.
Because that really wasn't a thing.
So that makes me wonder, is this a transfer? Like were they a street gang beforehand doing something else and were like, shit, let's get in on that, you know, computer crime? Or, I mean, they definitely have changed between the types of attacks and extortion they did. Although, yeah, I don't know, maybe they were doing like eBay fraud before.
Yeah, so it's just some kind of digital crime stuff for, you know, since 07.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that, you know, this is one of the higher ups in there, which seemed to indicate, you know, he was probably part of Ryuk and whatever came before it. But they also, on top of, you know, the security software and the VPN software, they also pay for OSINT.
This is where all that money's going.
It could be.
Have you seen how much some of those intelligence firms charge? This is, they could have blown millions of dollars on this.
Well, maybe. They seem to be pretty frugal, though. But I don't think they spend $170 million on OSINT. But they spend money on identifying who owns what IP address space, if an IP is tied to a VPN. They also have subscriptions to Crunchbase Pro and Zoom Info. And these two pieces of OSINT seem very valuable to the crew. So in there, you can find out how much insurance a company maintains, what their latest earning estimates are, contact information for the executives and board members. Because this really seems like their lead generator for who they're going to attack.
Yeah, and Zoom Info is going to have incredibly detailed information on. So Zoom Info, how they get their information is they say, you can have access to our database, but only if you install this extension into your Microsoft Outlook or whatever your email program is. And basically, they're offering access to their information in return for allowing them to slurp up your gal and all your contacts. So they would have incredibly detailed information on, you know, depending on what's in the gal, like your job title, who are the network administrators, who are the HR people, who are the legal people. They would have, depending on what you're trying to hit, they would have information on where people may live and what time zones they may be in. They would have just, that's unbelievable. It is, nobody. Have we ever seen a criminal organization that is paying for these legitimate services? I'm sure it's happened. This may be the first time I've ever seen it published, though.
Yeah. I mean, this is the peek behind the curtain that we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
And it makes complete sense that they're doing this stuff. You know, I was thinking we were talking about how they don't have a spammers team or anything like that. But if they have this lead generation engine, maybe they are just doing direct emails themselves with whoever on the team to say, hey, you're going to do the emails this week or something like that. Or, well, it wouldn't make sense for them to own this stuff and then pass it off to an access broker, or would it? Maybe they build their leads here. They send it to an access broker and say, hey, spam these guys, you know, and get us a foothold or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, or they could just ask the access broker, do you have any accounts right now? And, you know, for this domain, and then match up the accounts with the information from Zoom Info so they know who they've got.
Oh, yeah. So they give them a list and just tell us, you know, what overlap do you have? And then just give us that information. And surprise, surprise, Conti pays for Cobalt Strike. Now, that's a big shocker there. But actually, what is interesting about the way they acquire Cobalt Strike, though? So they pay $30,000 for the license, and they pay another $30,000 to a legitimate company to get the license for them. So they're paying double for what a Cobalt Strike license would generally cost, because they have that cutout that they have to use in order to get the license.
Which makes me wonder actually about the rest of their stuff that they purchased. Did they buy it? They couldn't have bought it under, hey, we're the Conti, you know, crime gang. We need a subscription to Zoom Info. I'm sure some of it allows individuals to purchase it, but like EDR stuff.
That depends on the vetting, really, that's necessary.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like the pen testing software probably does have a much stronger vetting process.
Because I'm not sure about the way Cobalt Strike sells their software, but there are a lot of security vendors that don't sell direct. You have to go through a VAR or a reseller. And most of those resellers, you know, I don't know why I'd say they're not scrupulous, but they don't have to put a lot of effort into getting a lot of research on their customers. There's no real upside for them doing that amount of work. Now, you know, we were talking about a minute ago, the idea that an employee within the ransomware group could, you know, end up walking off with the ransom, which is why the management doesn't trust the average employee there. But something that upper level team has been working on to kind of prevent that is they've been working on the idea of using a peer-to-peer network for based on smart contracts to ensure that both sides honor their part of the deal. So I'm going to quote from Jeff Laddish, who's a security consultant in Oakland, who penned a two-part analysis on why smart contracts and ransomware make a lot of sense. And he says, by using a smart contract, an operator can trustlessly sell their victim's decryption key for money. That is, a victim can send money to a smart contract with a guarantee that they will either receive the decryption key to their data or get their money back. The victim does not have to trust the person who hacked their computers because they can verify that the smart contract will fairly handle the exchange. And I think this is kind of genius because we've been talking about since ransomware even came out that in order for ransomware to be successful, victims have to trust their attackers in some way to ensure that the ransomware gang is going to provide them with the key. Otherwise, after a couple of times, no one will pay if no one gets their key. So if they were able to implement smart contracts, it would be almost guaranteed that the Conti ransomware group would be at the top of the list for Crimeware Yelp to say they are always provide the key because they do all this with smart contracts. And if you do it with smart contracts, I think that's going to prevent the middleman employees from possibly interjecting their own key and walking off with any of that ransom. I think it's genius.
Yeah, I see it does a couple of things. First of all, though, how would you be sure that what you're getting in the contract isn't smart because the actual decryption key? So you can guarantee you're getting something. Although again, like you said, why would they not send you the decryption key? Because then they won't last very long. A second, they could set it up automatically so that no humans even involved. Like when it ransoms, when it encrypts the disk, like maybe they have like a company identifier, it automatically goes out and creates that smart contract and they could put that on like the desktop. So nobody from the Conti gang has to be involved at all in any negotiations. They could just go out and pay it without even talking to a human. And third, whichever blockchain they choose to do this on is going to all of a sudden have a metric ton of money moving through it. Given, and I know we're not going to talk about this because we're running out of time, given that they're trying to create their own crypto universe and their own blockchain, like they could just create their own. And then now all of a sudden it's going to have millions of dollars moving through their own blockchain. And I don't know, that'd be interesting because then they're created, then they could, it could be used for legitimate things too.
Well, if they use one blockchain though, for only ransomware, I think it would be fairly easy for law enforcement then to isolate.
No, you're right. Cause the cryptocurrency, if there's no way to exchange it anywhere, how do the good guys get money into it to pay off the ransom? And how do the bad guys get the money out? You're right. It would make no sense to use their own blockchain. They'd have to use it. But all right, so whatever established one they use is going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah, but if they write the smart contract correctly, then it's going to be reviewed by both sides. Well, one side's going to create it and the other side's going to validate it. Say, hey, the CERT smart contract is well written and it ensures where you get our decryption key before we pay.
Now, and you could do like, they occasionally do a sample too, where they release a couple for free just to validate that they can decrypt it. So that could be built into the contract as well.
Right. Yeah, I think this is really smart. And if this gang survives, you know, this release of the chat logs here, I wouldn't be surprised if we actually see this coming to pass. Because these guys are obviously not stupid.
Nope. Just bad administrators.
Yeah. I'm just really surprised they're not doing more automation.
Reach out to me. We'll get this fixed up.
Maybe you should leave your contact information in the show notes.
I just have to learn Russian.
Well, tell them you do a discount for the translator.
I mean, they could probably hire him for $1,000 to $2,000 a month, right?
Right. Yeah. heck, if they pay you enough, you could say you take it out of my salary a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the reason that this is even important is taking a look behind the curtain for this ransomware game. These are serious people doing serious business. And you got to expect that they're going to work really hard, you know, to raise money, and they keep an eye on the bottom line for the organization. So don't underestimate these folks just because they're criminals, that they're operating this thing like a business, just like any other corporation would do.
And not only a business, a more well-funded business.
Like the majority like startup of money, crazy yeah. startup money.
Yeah. And a larger security team. I've never worked at a company that's had a security team of 87 people. I know there are a few, you know, Fortune 50, Fortune 10 companies, especially mm-hmm. banks probably have nice big security teams.
Right.
But the rest of us don't.
Yeah. Deal with the hand you're dealt.
Yeah.
But the only thing you can really do about it, besides taking these guys seriously, is, you know, there have been thousands of pages written on how to protect your ransomware or yourself from ransomware. So, you know, take their advice.
All right. Looks like we're about done, aren't we? Well, that looks like all the articles we have for today. We just picked one series and ran through it. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.